From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
The toe bone connected to the heel bone. The heel bone connected to the foot bone. The foot bone connected to the ankle bone. It's easy to connect those thigh bones.
Tonight, in part two of a special holiday edition of On Point, we bring you some of the country's top humor writers reading their own work in the fifth annual New Yorker Festival. When it first hit the stands in 1925, the New Yorker was referred to as a comic weekly. Humor's been a mainstay of the magazine ever since, with wits from A.J. Liebling to Dorothy Parker and, of course, the cartoons. To celebrate that legacy of laughter, contemporary New Yorker regulars, humorists Christopher Buckley, Calvin Trillin, David Owen, Paul Sims, Andy Borowitz, Steve Martin, and Paul Rudnick gathered for a public reading at the New Yorker Festival's A Humor Review. Tonight, we bring you a sampling and, we hope, a few laughs. Up first, Christopher Buckley, author of the best-selling humor books Rye Martinis, Thank You for Smoking, and Florence of Arabia. Tom Wolfe calls him one of the funniest writers in the English language. Joseph Heller described him as an effervescent joy. In this piece, Christopher Buckley looks forward to the wonder of winter holidays in How to Teach Your Four-Year-Old How to Ski.
On the neck bones connected to the chin bone. Chin bone connected to the nose bone. The nose bone connected to the head bone. Yeah, it's easy to connect the nose.
Set alarm for 4 a.m. in order to begin dressing process of child. Note: allow at least a half hour for locating left mitten, which child does not remember having used for toy soldier's sleeping bag the night before. Drop child off at resort's ski bunny program. Banter cheerfully with staff as you attempt to pry hysterical child from your leg. Affect bemusement over his insistence that he does not want to be enrolled in ski bunny program. Tell staff the child actually loves skiing and is really adorable once he stops screaming. Slip staff $20 bills for treats. Head off with wife, teary over abandoning child. Stand in 30-minute long lift line. Attempt to console wife by remarking how impressed you were with the professionalism of the ski bunny program staff. Also, remark how you had forgotten how cold it sometimes gets in Vermont and how windy with today's nippy gale force wind blowing down from Baffin Island. Impress her by calculating that the wind chill factor comes out to 33 degrees below zero. As you reach head of lift line, remain calm as public address system loudspeaker announces, will the parents of your child's name please report to the Ski Bunny program immediately. Arrive to find child physically intact, but hyperventilatingly adamant that he will not remain one more minute in Ski Bunny program. Despite their professionalism, staff members eagerly concur. Agree to wife's proposal that you have fun bonding experience by teaching child to ski yourself. As she disappears in search of chemical warming packs to counteract numbness in extremities, fasten harness around child and, using reins, repeatedly pull delighted child 100 yards up baby slope until your knees begin to make crunching sound similar to snapping stalks of celery, audible even through thickly insulated ski pants. Convince wary child that he is ready to go with you on ski lift. Emphasize how much fun it will be. Attempt to reassure a child as gusts of Canadian air rock ski lift seat wildly from side to side, 100 meters above the slopes. Explain, too, that it is normal for the ski lift to stop every 3 minutes for long periods. Tell him that you cannot feel your nose either. Slowly but surely accept the fact that you have erroneously gotten on a lift to the summit. Thereby committing yourselves to a bonding experience you'll both remember for years. As end of lift approaches, attempt to persuade panicking child that the machinery was not expressly invented for purposes of mangling his limbs. With dubious child held firmly between your legs, begin snow plowing down several thousand yards of ice, covered with a thin dusting of artificial snow. This is Vermont, after all, but think how much money you save by not going to one of those expensive places out west. Try to ignore acute shooting pains in your lumbar region by focusing on the interesting new pain on the insides of your knees. It's all coming back. Remind yourself that with recent advances in arthroscopic surgical technique, you'll be walking normally in weeks. Whoopsie daisy. Apologize to child for falling on top of him. Try to make him laugh by pointing out that the tip of his ski is embedded in your left eye. See? When lumbar pain increases to unignorable levels of intensity, tell child you are going to have even more fun by hooking yourselves together with the kiddie harness. Fall down on ice and, spinning like a wildly thrown Argentine bola, cartwheel down the mountain. Reassure child that death is not imminent by shouting, "Wee!" And isn't this neat? Attempt to stop by grabbing onto leg of passing skier. Profusely apologize to skier, who it turns out is a successful negligence lawyer from Manhattan. Continue bola-like descent. Hat bottom, hand over frozen, traumatized child to furious wife, who, having stuffed her clothing with $200 worth of chemical warming packs, resembles a scarecrow. Remain flat on back for duration of scathing lecture on your incompetence as a ski instructor. Note, wife does not care that you have no feeling in your legs. Thank you.
Christopher Buckley, his latest book is Florence of Arabia.
Hello, daddy skier, won't you wait up on me?
He don't hot dog, he don't jump.
Cruising down the slopes just as fast as can be.
He don't crash nuts on his rump.
The one thing he does in any kind of weather is keep his skis very close together. Mellow daddy skier is what I want to be.
Calvin Trillin is one of America's most beloved humorists. He's written for Time magazine and had a regular column at The Nation that USA Today dubbed simply the funniest regular column in journalism. He's author of more than 20 books, most recently, Obliviously On He Sails, The Bush Administration in Rhyme. In this reading, Calvin Trillin points the sharp end of his pen at the American passion for advice columns in Unpublished Letters to the Ethicist.
To the Ethicist. My husband, who is an anti-abortion activist, sincerely believes that life begins at conception. Recently, he learned that he was conceived while his parents were on vacation in Jamaica, and he has come to the conclusion that he is therefore a Jamaican. And in this country illegally. He is now talking about turning himself in and having himself deported. Am I married to a man of principle or a cuckoo bird? D.F., Tupelo, Mississippi. To the ethicist. For 6 years, I was the CEO of a large conglomerate. Then in 2000, there was a precipitous drop in the company's stock. Fortunately, by complete coincidence, I had sold $87 million worth of shares a week before. For the final 3 years of my tenure, I had a compensation package that included one of those Jack Welch riders. I was entitled to any perk that Jack got. According to the Compensation Committee's reasoning, if Jack had something that I didn't have, I could suffer a loss of self-esteem that in the long run would be detrimental to the interests of our shareholders. Now I find that Jack was getting free Yankee tickets and I wasn't. I'm planning to sue my old company for the cost of the tickets, although given the company's current financial situation, it's in Chapter 11, I might only get 10 or 15 cents on the dollar. My wife says that some people could consider the suit unseemly, with so many employees having lost their retirement money and all. But don't you think that fair's fair? The thought of Jack sitting in that box in Yankee Stadium just burns my ass. BP, Naples, Florida. To the ethicist, we are advisors to the president of a very powerful country. And we are prominent in a group of so-called hawks urging him to wage war on Iraq. Like every other member of the group, we evaded the war in Vietnam. Some people see some ethical problem in this. They refer to us as chicken hawks. But we figure that if we had gone to Vietnam, we could have been killed. And then, who would be here to urge the president to wage war on Iraq? D.C., R.P., and P.W., Washington, D.C. To the ethicist. I was brought up in a Jewish home, but I haven't been observant in many years. Last summer, in a rash moment, I said publicly that if Martha Stewart got indicted, I would go back to the synagogue. Now that such an indictment seems likely, I am in a quandary. My older daughter believes that if Ms. Stewart is indicted, my obligations would include attending services regularly, maintaining a kosher home, and refraining from operating a motor vehicle on Shemini Atzeret. My younger daughter thinks that I might at least be able to get a waiver on that business about changing dishes for Passover. I want to keep my word, but I'm wondering whether maybe a Friday night service or two might do the trick. CT, New York. Thank you.
Calvin Trillin reading his own work from The New Yorker. There's more to come after the break, including readings by Paul Sims, Steve Martin, and more in this special edition Humor Review. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight, in a special edition of On Point, we're bringing you some of America's best humor writing from the New Yorker magazine, read and recorded at this fall's New Yorker Festival.
How'd you like to know your top? Dig yourself some fine rebop. Hidey, hidey, hidey.
Writer Paul Sims is best known as creator of the hit television sitcom News Radio. He was earlier a writer for The Larry Sanders Show. Sims has a sharp eye for the often absurd, sometimes self-satirizing, rough and tumble of American politics. In an intense political year like the one we've just come through, one event stands out for Sims, the date, June 24th, the location, the floor of the U.S. Senate, the players, Vice President Dick Cheney and Democratic Senator from Vermont, Patrick Leahy. After a tense exchange on politics, religion, Halliburton, and money, the vice president let slip some crude advice for the senator. Moralists were shocked. The media had a field day with Cheney's profanity. Paul Sims imagined what might have happened if the verbal dust-up had escalated into a full-blown street rumble.
This piece is based on a news story that happened a few months ago, which was reported in the Washington Times as follows. Vice President Dick Cheney cursed at Senator Patrick J. Leahy, Vermont Democrat, in a confrontation on the Senate floor while members were having their annual group picture taken earlier this week. Senate aides said the Vice President confronted Mr. Leahy about some of the Democrats' accusations of improprieties in military contracts awarded to Halliburton. Mr. Leahy then brought up charges of anti-Catholicism made last year by White House allies against Democrats. According to an aide, Mr. Cheney then responded with a barnyard epithet, urging Mr. Leahy to perform an anatomical sexual impossibility. And that was from the Washington Times. After Mr. Cheney successfully delivered the epithet and started to walk away, Mr. Leahy, sotto voce, referred to the vice president using a term more often heard in taverns and locker rooms than in the august Senate chamber, a term that refers to a sexual act commonly acknowledged as taboo among all cultures that prescribe incestuous contact between a mother and a son. Mr. Cheney, apparently hearing Mr. Leahy's remark, stopped, turned, and invited his colleague from across the aisle to engage in a sexual act that is considered a felony in some states. And which involves oral genital contact. Mr. Leahy then suggested that the... Mr. Leahy then suggested that the president of the Senate take his gavel and use it to perform an act that, while not technically impossible in anatomical terms, would certainly be considered both unseemly and unhygienic, and which would require an unusual combination of single-minded ambition and physical relaxation. Mr. Cheney wasted no time in informing Mr. Leahy that he should feel free to perform yet another anatomical impossibility, this one involving aviation, a standard sexual act, and a rolling donut. At this point, according to observers, both statesmen decided, by seemingly unspoken mutual consent, to abandon the gutter patois of the common carnival worker and to resort instead to an eminently more quotable, but to those not versed in the vagaries of hip-hop idiom, more confusing exchange of viewpoints. Oh, it's like that, Mr. Cheney queried. What, Mr. Leahy shot back? Once again, Mr. Cheney replied, quite obviously quoting a lyric from Ice Cube's 1990 album, America's Most Wanted, "It's on." As a quick-thinking senatorial aide switched on the Senate's public address system and queued up the infamous 7 minutes of funk break, Mr. Leahy and Mr. Cheney went head-to-head in what can only be described as a take-no-prisoners freestyle rap battle. Most of the rhymes kicked therein cannot be quoted in a family publication, but observers gave Mr. Cheney credit for his deceptively laid-back flow. Mr. Leahy was applauded for managing to rhyme the phrases unethical for certain, crude oil spurtin', and like Halliburton. Despite the fact that both participants brought their A game and succeeded in dropping mad scientifics, the bout seemed to end in a draw. Unfortunately, as other senators, along with assorted aides and support staff members, were casting their votes to decide the winner, using the admittedly subjective but generally accepted make some noise up in here protocols, Mr. Cheney and Mr. Leahy took the proceedings to what one aide accurately described as the next level. Edward M. Kennedy, Democrat, Massachusetts, was the first to notice that the two men were circling each other, Mr. Cheney brandishing a switchblade and Mr. Leahy the jagged neck of a broken bottle. Oh, snap, Mr. Kennedy recalls thinking at the time. It's getting kind of hectic up in this piece. But before either of the aggrieved public servants could bust a potentially injurious move on his rival, cooler heads prevailed. A veteran Capitol Hill security guard pacified the bloodthirsty white men. Mr. Leahy first, then Mr. Cheney, with a shot from a tranquilizer gun. He then had them returned to their cages in the sub-basement of the old executive office building, where both men are kept and fed during non-business hours under the watchful eye of a volunteer from Washington's National Zoo.
Paul Sims is creator of the hit television sitcom News Radio.
When will we all awake about this dream? Come here and smell the Folgers, the souls of the human beings. Man acting as if he was the supreme being. Talking to soul submit out like he was G-O-D and W-A-R-A. There'll be no tomorrow, but sorrow and horror will follow. The hollow hearts battle for dollars. Politicians, modern day magicians, positions of death for health, care for poor health. Who making us ill? They making us kill. It's making me spill my guts. Chill big, leg in the cut. For what? I refuse to sit in the backseat and get handled like I do nothing all day. But sit around, watch the cartoon channel. I rap about the presidential election and the scandal that followed. And we all watch the nation as it swallowed and chalked it up. Basically, America, you got the media shut the job. Now we stuck. Damn.
Andy Borowitz is a political humorist, TV commentator, and the man behind the news parody website BorowitzReport.com. The Cleveland native is also creator of the smash TV comedy The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Along with writing for The New Yorker, he regularly contributes to CNN's American Morning, NPR's Morning Edition, and The New York Times, and is winner of the first National Press Club Award for humor. But in this piece, Andy Borowitz turns his attention away from political humor and toward the little-known, behind-the-scenes life of one of America's most beloved yet reclusive poets, Emily Dickinson.
It was with great reluctance that I decided to write about my 30-year friendship with Emily Dickinson. To many who would read my book, Miss Dickinson was a cherished literary icon, and any attempt to describe her in human terms would, understandably, be resented. And yet, by not writing this book, I would be depriving her most ardent admirers of meeting the Emily Dickinson I was privileged to know. More than a mentor, she was my anchor, my compass, my lighthouse. Except when she was drunk. At those times, usually beginning at the stroke of noon, she became a gluttonous, vituperative harpy who would cut you for your last buffalo wing. Once she got hold of her favorite beverage, Old English malt liquor, the Belle of Amherst would, as she liked to put it, get polluted till she booted. This Emily Dickinson would think nothing of spitting chewing tobacco in a protege's face, blithely explaining that she was working on her aim. Who then was the real Emily Dickinson? Daughter of New England in chaste service to her poetry? Or backstabbing Gorgon, who doctored your bowling score when you went out to get more nachos? By exploring this question, I decided I had a chance not only to learn about Miss Dickinson, but also to learn about myself, and to learn even more about myself if the book went into paperback. When I first met Miss Dickinson, I was a literary greenhorn with a handful of unfinished poems, struggling to find my voice and something that rhymed with Nantucket. Believing that she would be more likely to take me under her wing if I appeared to be an ingenue, I entered her lace-curtained parlor in Amherst dressed as a Cub Scout. But she took no note of my attire as she read over that day's work. Parting is all we know of heaven and all we need of hell. Putting down her quill, she brushed the bonnet-crowned curls from her forehead. Well, it beats stealing cars. She croaked in a husky baritone, declaring that quittin' time is spittin' time. She reached into her sewing box for a pouch of her favorite chaw, as she called it, and pulled a tall and foamy out of the icebox. She generously agreed to look over my poems, pork rinds spilling from her mouth as she read. Finally, she anointed my efforts with words of encouragement that would sustain me throughout my early career. You're a poet and you don't know it. Your feet show it. They're Longfellows. Now I gotta hit the head. Years passed before I saw another, less merry aspect of Miss Dickinson's character at a book party for Ralph Waldo Emerson. Miss Dickinson was experiencing a trough in her career. She had been reduced to writing advertising copy, most notably, "Nothing is better for thee than me" for Quaker Oats. At the party, Miss Dickinson sat alone at the bar, doing tequila shooters and riffing moribund, angry couplets that often did not scan. I sensed that it was time to take her home. In the parking lot, she stopped abruptly near Emerson's car. "Let's key it," she said, her eyes dancing maniacally. I assumed that this was just Emily being Emily, and I tried to laugh it off. "Don't be such a wuss," she said, scratching "Waldo sucks" into the passenger door. I gently upbraided Miss Dickinson for her actions, which only served to inflame her. "Emerson's trying to steal my juice, baby. It took me years to get where I am. Understand what I'm saying? I used to run 3-card Monte on the streets of Newton, and I ain't going back." At this moment, I found myself confronted with a possibility that I had never wanted to consider in all our years of friendship. Emily Dickinson was a real jerk. Some years later, Boston University asked me to moderate a panel including Miss Dickinson, William Dean Howells, and the author, long since forgotten, of the verse "Finders, Keepers, Losers, Weepers." I was by this time a successful poet in my own right, having become renowned for my series of "Happiness Is" gift books and pillows. (Laughter) Seated next to Miss Dickinson, I attempted to mend the breach that had developed in our relationship. I went on at some length about our debt to her work. She took a sip of water, cleared her throat, and replied, "Bite me, you self-aggrandizing weasel." The last time I saw Emily Dickinson, she said she didn't have time to speak, as she was on her way to the Greyhound races in Taunton. But I could not let her go without asking what had happened to our friendship. Her eyes downcast, she said simply, "You've got ketchup on your tie." Quizzically, I lowered my head and took a right uppercut to the jaw. As I crumpled to the pavement, Miss Dickinson unleashed a profane tirade along with a pistol whipping that was startling for both its vigor and its efficiency. As I review this last memory, it occurs to me that some readers might conclude that I am trying to cast Emily Dickinson in a negative light. Nothing could be further from my intentions. In fact, when I regained consciousness, I realized that Miss Dickinson, in her tirade, had given me a final, precious gift. True, I no longer had my wallet. But I had, at long last, a separate identity, a voice, and perhaps most valuable of all, a rhyme for Nantucket. Thank you.
Andy Borowitz reading his work, Emily Dickinson, Jerk of Amherst. His latest book is The Borowitz Report, The Big Book of Shuckers.
No one to talk with all by myself. No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the shelf. A misbehaving, saving my love for you, for you, for you, for you. I know for certain the one I love. I'm through with flirting, it's you that I'm thinking of. A misbehaving, saving all my love for you.
There's more to come after the break in our special edition humor review. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight, in a special edition of On Point, we're bringing you some of America's best humor writing from the New Yorker magazine, read and recorded at this fall's fifth annual New Yorker Festival. We'll end tonight with two readings inspired by one of the biggest cultural stories of the year, the release of Mel Gibson's controversial movie blockbuster, The Passion of the Christ. The first reading comes from one of Hollywood's wisest and wittiest insiders, Steve Martin. The actor, writer, producer, and director is the only person to have hosted both the Academy Awards and the National Book Awards ceremonies. Steve Martin shines in his crossover talent, spanning the worlds of literary fiction and Hollywood movies in this piece, Studio Script Notes on The Passion.
Dear Mel, we love, love the script. The ending works great. Did not see it coming. You'll be getting a call from us to start negotiations for the book rights. Love the Jesus character. So likable. He can't seem to catch a break. We identify with him because of it. One thing, I think we need to clearly state the rules. Why doesn't he use his superpowers to save himself? Our creative people suggest that you could simply cut away to two spectators. Spectator one, why doesn't he use his superpowers to save himself? Spectator two, He can only use his powers to help others, never himself. Mel, does it matter which garden? Gethsemane is hard to say, and Eden is a much more recognizable garden. Just thinking out loud. Our creative people suggest a clock visual fading in and out in certain scenes, like the Last Supper bit. Monday, 5:43 p.m. Or later, Good Friday, 4:42 p.m. Love the repetition of, "Is it I, O Lord?" Could be very funny. On the eighth inquiry, could Jesus give a little look of exasperation into camera? It breaks frame, but could be a riot. Also, could he change water into wine in the Last Supper scene? That would be a great moment, and it's legit. History compression is a movie tradition and could really brighten up the scene. Great trailer moment, too. Love the flaying. Could the rabbis be Hispanic? There's lots of hot Latino actors right now. Could give us a little zing at the box office. Research says there's some historical justification for it. Possible title change, Lethal Passion. Kinda works. The more I say it out loud, the more I like it. Is there somewhere where Jesus could be using an iMac? You know, now that I hear myself say it, it sounds ridiculous. Strike that, but think about it. Maybe we start a shot in heaven with Jesus thoughtfully closing the top. Love the idea of Monica Bellucci as Mary Magdalene. Yow! Our creative people suggest a name change to Ashley. Could skew our audience a little younger. Love Judas. Such a great villain. Our creative people suggest that he's a little complicated. Couldn't he be one thing, just bad? Gives the movie much more of a motor. Also, 30 pieces of silver is not going to get anyone excited. I think it's very simple to make him a new millionaire. Bring in the cash on a tray, great dilemma that the audience can identify with. Merchandising issue. It seems the cross image is public domain and we can't own it. Could the crucifixion scene involve something else? A Toyota would be wrong. But maybe there's a shape we can copyright, like a wagon wheel. Minor spelling error. On page 18, in the description of the bystanders, there should be a space between the words Jew and boy. Finally, I'm assuming your note saying that the dialogue is in Aramaic is a typo for American. If not, call me on my cell or I'm home all weekend. Thank you.
Steve Martin, reading his work, Studio Script Notes for The Passion.
Hooray for Hollywood! You may be homely in your neighborhood.
Be an actor, see Mr. Factor, you make your kisser look good.
Go out and try your luck. Hooray for Hollywood!
Hooray for Hollywood!
At the tender age of 5, Paul Rudnick declared himself a playwright, though he had yet to set foot near a stage. The precocious kid went on to write the Obie Award-winning play Jeffrey, screenplays for Sister Act and Adam's Family Values. In this piece, he offers a reverent but alternative take on the life of Jesus, told from the point of view of a teenage Christian acolyte circa the year 30 in The Gospel of Debbie.
Recent works like The Passion of the Christ and The Da Vinci Code seek to illuminate the life of Jesus. Not long ago, an additional text was discovered in an ancient linen backpack, found in a cave outside Jerusalem, surrounded by what appeared to be early Roman candy wrappers, and covered with stickers reading, "I Heart All Faiths," and "Ask Me About Hell." A parchment diary found inside the backpack appears to contain the musings of one Debbie of Galilee. Many of the pages are still being translated from high school Aramaic. Here are some persuasive excerpts. October 5th. I saw him in the marketplace. Everyone says that he's the son of God, but I don't care one way or the other because he is just so cute. Okay, he's not hot like a gladiator or a centurion, but he's really sensitive, and you can tell that he, like, thinks about things. And then he goes, be nice to people. And I'm like, that is so true. And I wonder if he's seeing anyone. October 21st. Everyone says that he's just totally good and devoted to all humanity and that he was sent to save us. And that's why he doesn't have time for a girlfriend. Although I swear, I saw Mary Magdalene doodling in the sand with a stick, writing, Mrs. Jesus Christ. And Mary Xmas from Mary and Jesus Christ and all the apostles, with little holly leaves all around it. And I'm like, Mary, are you dating Jesus? And she says, no, he's just helping me. And I'm like, you mean with math? And she's like, no, to not be such a whore. And I said, but that is so incredibly sweet. And we both screamed and talked about whether we liked him better when he's healing the lame or with a ponytail. December 25th. I wanted to get him the perfect thing for his birthday. So I asked Matthew, and he said, well, myrrh is good. But then Luke said, oh, please. Everyone always gives him myrrh. I bet he wishes those wise men had brought scented candles, some imported marmalade, and a nice box of note cards. So I go, okay, what about accessories? Like a new rope belt or clogs, or like I could make him a necklace with his name spelled out in little clay letters. And Mark said, I love that. But Luke rolled his eyes and said, Mark, you are just such an Assyrian. So I go to see Mary, Jesus' mom, and she said that Jesus doesn't need gifts, that he just wants all of us to love God and be better people. But I asked, what about a sweater? And she said, medium. January 2nd. Oh, my God, oh, my God, I couldn't believe it. But I was right there. And Jesus used only 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish to feed thousands of people. And it was so beautiful and miraculous. And my brother Ezekiel said, whoa, Jesus has invented canapes. And I said, shut up. And then my best friend Rachel asked, I wonder if he could make my hair really shiny. And I said, you are so disgusting. Jesus shouldn't waste his time on your vanity. And then Jesus smiled at me. And I'm telling you, those last 7 pounds, the stubborn ones, totally gone. And I spoke unto the angry Roman mob. And I said, behold these thighs. Jesus has made me feel better about me. March 12th. Everyone is just getting so mean. They're all going, Debbie, he is so not divine. Debbie, you'll believe anything. Debbie, what about last year when you were worshiping ponchos? And I so don't trust that Judas Iscariot, who's always staring at me when I, like, walk to the well, and he's saying, hey, Deb, nice jugs. And I'm like, oh, ha, 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 get some oxen. April 5th. So Mary Magdalene tells me that Jesus and all the apostles had this big party and that it got really intense and Jesus drank from this golden goblet and now it's missing. And the restaurant is like, this is why there's a surcharge. April 23rd. It's all over. And it's been terrible and amazing. And I don't know what any of it means or who's right and who's wrong, but maybe I'll figure it out later. Anyway, I'll always remember what Jesus said to me. He said, Debbie, I can foresee that someday you'll meet someone wonderful, but for right now, let's at least think about college. Amen.
Paul Rudnick reading his piece, The Gospel of Debbie, at the 2004 New Yorker Festival. That wraps up our special holiday edition of Writers Reading Their Own Work at the 5th Annual New Yorker Festival. Special thanks tonight to Daniel Kyle and the writers and staff of the New Yorker for their partnership in bringing you this broadcast. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Rachel Dornhelm, Lauren Madelon, Michael Garth, and Tim Skog. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Although he may not be the man's son, girls think of as handsome, but to my heart he carries the key. Tell him, please, to put on some speed.